Joined on the line now by Rosalind Carroll. She's Chief Executive of the Personal Injuries Assessment Board, and we're going to be talking about PIAB's annual report for 2020. Rosalind, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Now, the report, I suppose, its headline is a 50% drop in compensation values since the introduction of new guidelines. But there was also a decrease in the number of claims lodged. And I think most people could intuit that that was attributable in part to the fact of the pandemic.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we saw quite a significant decrease in claims coming into us last year. So in 2019, we would have 31,000 personal injury claims coming into us. And in 2020, that dropped by 16% to 26,000. So a significant drop, but yes, driven majorly by the pandemic, but is following a slight decrease that had already taken place the previous year. So in the past 2 years, we've now seen a 22% drop in claims coming in. And what that means is the total value of awards we would have given out in 2019 would have been 275 million. That dropped to 206 million. So 70 million saved in terms of awards overall.
I think most people would have expected a greater reduction than 16% in the number of claims lodged with you last year, Rosalind, given that so much of the country spent much of that year in level 5 or certainly level 3 lockdown. We had two level 5 lockdowns here with us in County Kildare. But is that in part attributable to the fact that, you don't instantly receive the claim upon the occurrence of the incident? There is a time lag.
Yes, you're right. Typically, it's between 11 and 12 months later that we might see a claim coming into us from when an accident occurred. So what you'll have seen last year is the start, actually, of the impact of COVID. And what we're saying is that continues into 2021, and given that we've had restrictions during 2021 also now, will continue into 2022. So what you should see over the next 2 to 3 years, and we don't normally hear many good news stories from COVID, but it has led to less accidents, which leads to less claims, which should, I suppose, in turn then lead to reductions in insurance.
And should really is the probative word. There should insurers in their various guises and forms elect to pass those on to their customers really remains to be seen, or if they, what order they may elect to do so. Now, one interesting facet is that acceptance rates have fallen from 58% to 51% since 2015. So PIAB would make a recommendation based on the facts before it as to the order of the award that should be given, and the proportion of claimants that accept that has gone down.
Yeah, now it's been fairly stable, kind of 51% for the last couple of years, but you're right, and at one point we had it up at over 60%. And so what happens is we go out and we independently will assess an award where it hasn't been settled directly with an insurance company. And when we do that, we go out and we do our own medical assessment, and then we look at the injury and compare it, and then do an assessment of what that compensation should add up to, weighing up the evidence. And the Central Bank has found, actually, for motor claims and now for public liability and employer liability claims, that the awards we're given are broadly in line with what you're getting in terms of settlements post PIAB. But nonetheless, we have, over the last number of years, only had 52% of claimants accepting awards, claimants and respondents. That's primarily driven, I think, by people kind of thinking, oh, maybe I'll do better. Maybe I'll do better if I wait. Now, one of the important changes that we've had this year is the personal injuries guidelines were introduced. And what that means is they come in now and they're applicable to everybody. So the judges must use them and PIAB must use them. And they've recalibrated awards, but they're also much more granular more prescriptive in nature. So that potential variance that people maybe thought was there before isn't there in the same way. And what we're hoping that will lead to is a broader acceptance. That will take time to come in, and the culture to kind of adopt, and the, you know, for the faith and the system to work. But we do believe that it's a very important change. A lot of the focus sometimes is on just the award values, but a lot of the cost of claims is driven up by the associated costs. So the Central Bank, when you looked at motor claims coming in, the average kind of amount coming out with about 24,000 votes through the litigation channel and through PIAB. But when you added in the add-on costs in the litigation channel, it ended up at being €40,000, the cost of the claim, compared to 24,000 in PIAB. So hugely adding costs to the system.
One thing that I do find really interesting in the report is the geographical breakdown of awards by the county of claimant addresses. Now, I would imagine, I'm not a statistician or an actuary, that your average common or garden accident, which you might encounter, Rosalind, and your colleagues on a daily basis, is as likely to happen in place A as place B, all other things being equal. But I'm just looking here at Kildare, 412 claimants from Kildare. Then our next door neighbours, Wicklow, 169. Meath was 361. Now, their populations are broadly similar. And Meath in particular has a broadly similar demographic breakdown in terms of the areas of work in which its residents may engage in a broadly similar geographical context. To what might you attribute that kind of regional variation?
Yeah, it's difficult to know in terms of without getting into the detail of the data. What I can say is the numbers are down in Kildare as they would be across the country. So they did come down from 540 claims coming in that area to 412. But sometimes, and I don't know that the RSA, the Road Safety Authority, came out yesterday, and it might be down to the nature of the roads. It's in some cases that's what's led to certainly fatalities and serious injuries, but it's difficult to tell what that could be without doing a significant analysis of the Kildare area, which we will go and do and look after. We've had to look at these broad figures today.
Yeah, because we see a place like Louth, the wee county, 333 claimants, and then you would expect places with a much lower population level, Sligo and Roscommon, etc. They had 89 and 78 respectively, and accidents can occur at any time, and I'm not making any particular point by comparing the figures geographically. It's just really notable, the wide variation. What's your personal key takeaway, Rosalind, from this report?
I suppose there's a couple of things. The big thing for us is there's a decrease, and we should be looking at the benefits of that decrease. The second thing, I suppose, is, you know, using it as a benchmark, I suppose, to measure where are we going to get in terms of these new personal injury guidelines. As I said, when you look at individual awards, the average individual award was €24,000 last year. We've already done preliminary analysis in terms of implementing the new personal injury guidelines, and that's coming down to about 12,000 for the first, you know, few hundred cases that we looked at. So it's an important marker for us to look back on when we're looking at in terms of the new guidelines. There's probably some takeaways there as well as in terms of prevention. So we've added this year some information and kind of case studies of some of the cases that are coming into us. And you're talking there even about Kildare and the numbers of the roads. And what we're trying to now do is dive deeper into cases to see, can we do something to help prevent some of these cases happening? And you can see when you start looking at the actual individual kinds of cases. So most of our cases come in are motor cases. And we can see in that the main kind of person affected in terms of injury coming in is drivers. But 31% are passengers. And we've also seen, you know, that cyclists have remained stable, which you would have thought maybe that would be a growing number. So that stayed at 5%. The other kind of key thing around kind of the motor side of things is the main injury that we see coming in is for soft tissue injury, or sometimes known as whiplash. Now, that's one of the injuries that's kind of been reduced most within the new guidelines. It was a particular focus in the new guidelines. So therefore, you would expect the guidelines to have quite a significant impact as a result of that. And then kind of looking at the prevention side of things, particularly when you're looking at workplace accidents and accidents in public places. So 64% of the accidents in public places, so that could be in your local pub, your local restaurant, on the pavement, were caused by slips, trips and falls on the same surface level. And typically what we see coming in there is maybe a trip in a supermarket where things have been left out on the aisle when you're going to stock the shelves. That's a typical thing that we would see coming into us. So these are things that are easily rectified if we kind of adapt our behaviour. And the second thing then, in terms of workplace accidents, it's much more varied what you'd see. You see slips, trips and falls are there for 20%, but 15% are falling objects. So one of the other cases we would have seen last year coming in would have been, you know, in these walk-in fridges, things not being stored correctly, and big, heavy loads of milk coming down and causing huge damage to people because of the weight of them. So, you know, those things are all things that we can also do to help. Because remember, insurance is there because an accident has occurred.
Yeah. Well, Rosalind Carroll, Chief Executive of the Personal Injuries Assessment Board, thank you indeed for joining us. Interested to hear your views on this. So the number of people at weddings can increase from 50 to 100 from the 5th of August. Cabinet signed off on the move this morning after initially deciding not to proceed. There was indeed a protest of some brides-to-be outside the Department of Health on this matter earlier today. Baptism ceremonies will also be allowed to take place in August, but what is interesting is that an awful lot of pregnant and expected people on Twitter are tweeting that they still cannot have their partners with them at probative points, either of their labour, of anomaly scans, because restrictions remain in being in some form or another at many of Ireland's maternity hospitals. 0833 97 97 97. Now, Unite Trade Union has conducted a survey of its members working in hospitality, and it has painted a very bleak picture of the experience of many of the respondents. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Unite's Hospitality and Tourism Coordinator, Yulia Markiniak. Yulia, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Kira. Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me.
Delighted to do so. This is really, really timely, given that we are seeing the resumption of indoor dining and indoor hospitality across the country. But I suppose that the headline takeaway from the study is high levels of low pay, bullying and discrimination amongst the respondents.
Yes, unfortunately, that is a reality for many workers. And I'm sorry, I just want to make clear that the survey was run with our members and it was run online as well. So about 15% of respondents are union members. The rest is just people, you know, following the link online. So it's like all workers, not only the union members there. But yes, in fact, the findings are absolutely shocking. And unfortunately, they are not shocking for the workers, because it seems like they experience that bad treatment and exploitation on regular basis. And, you know, like, we are talking here about very, very basic workers' rights, like a right to rest. It's absolutely unacceptable, the condition of the sector, and we really need to fight for change, for better. And I'm so delighted that we have that opportunity to speak on workers' behalf, because in the recent weeks, all we can hear it's reports from the employers, how they're struggling to recruit staff, and, you know, they problems. But then,
and many of those employers, certainly by no means all, but many of the employers and the employers' representative groups who are in the hospitality space are pointing to the pandemic unemployment payment as the reason why staff are not returning to them. But I think most people would find that to be a counterintuitive explanation. And a lot of people working in hospitality have pointed to the terms and conditions of employment and the day-to-day experience of working there. Like, if 70% are not getting their breaks during a working day, if half are not receiving their tips or are unaware of tipping practices in their workplace, if three quarters are saying their workplace is deliberately understaffed, and that word deliberately is very important, that 70% are experiencing bullying, that paints a very grim picture for a lot of people working in hospitality.
Unfortunately, it is. And actually, if I can get back to a pandemic unemployment payment, our respondents, 65% of people who respond to survey say they experience financial losses. And in fact, everyone on pandemic unemployment payment, everyone on the maximum rate, because there are four rates, but the maximum rate of 350, it's only for the people who are earning previously 400 or more. So, you know, it's very unfair. And as well, you know, all those calls from the employers' bodies to stop, to cut off the pandemic unemployment payment even before the sector fully reopens is just tell you all. And actually, it was a tweet yesterday from Adrian Cummins referring to workers as a human capital. And I think, like, honestly, we really, like, you know, because we see a lot of numbers there in the survey, and I would really want people to think about those numbers and actual people behind it.
Mm.
Their friends, their family members, going through all the abuse, exploitation, low wages, and actually, when it comes to low wages, then over half are on below living wage. But what is even more shocking, then 30% of people on supervisor manager position, they are still below living wage. That's kind of explain why over 70% do not see any career in the future in the sector.
And
it needs to change.
I would imagine people who are listening to you and I have this conversation, Yulia, who either have never worked in hospitality or no longer do so, are saying, well, sure, why don't you leave and work elsewhere?
It's very difficult to change the job, and especially during pandemic. And it's very difficult as well, like, you know, even because obviously a lot of those people are young, they are migrant workers, they don't have a qualification or they don't have a language to move somewhere. There is no, like, you know, there is no enough jobs in different sectors, and as well, I believe, like, we get a such a huge potential in the sector. It's one of the key components of Irish economy.
Mm.
And, you know, to let that to waste and treat the workers the way they are treated is just unbelievable. I do believe that there is actually a lot of employers who still provide workers with all the entitlements, but then others just taking advantage, and
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, it's unfair to workers, it's unfair to other, to the businesses, which are doing the right thing right there. And, you know, the same, it's applied to tips, when not only workers suffer, the customers are being misled because they believe then the tips are going to the staff. Then all the, some establishments actually allowed workers to keep their tips, and, you know, they just, the competition is really unfair for many, many reasons. But, you know, what is even more scary than some of the people who took a part in the survey to the question, for example, about the holiday, if they get all the entitlements, 16% say, I don't know. So that indicates that they basically do not know what they are entitled to.
Well, Yulia Marciniak, Hospitality Tourism Coordinator with Unite, thank you indeed for joining us to share with us your findings in that survey, not only of Unite members, but of other members across the hospitality sector in Ireland. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking pharmacies and the Fair Deal Scheme. Just shy of two-thirds of all pharmacies in Ireland were victims of crime over the last 12 months. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Dermot Tooney. He's president of the Irish Pharmacy Union. Dermot, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
I would imagine pharmacies, just by dint of the kind of business that they do, are always going to be targets for criminals. But that proportion of your members being targeted by criminal acts in a 12-month period seems extraordinarily high.
Yes, indeed. I think 65% of the was the figure of all pharmacies that were victims of crime in the last year. And it is very high. Now, it varies from, I suppose, simple theft of cosmetics or supplements or fake tan, all the way up to raids and you know, where pharmacists have been held at knife point or have had medicines like controlled drugs stolen.
And all other, I mean, that must be an absolutely terrifying experience for any of your members that encountered a thief or somebody coming to wreak havoc on their business. But all of the items you mentioned, incredibly resaleable, which is the attraction for any would-be thief.
Yes, indeed, Ciarán. I suppose probably what happened in the last year as well is, as you know, many retail businesses were shut. So, you know, pharmacies, I suppose, were more visible in the community, and with other businesses not being open or available, pharmacies were probably targeted more than in the past. And that's been an issue as well. And I suppose what we're trying to do is look after the healthcare needs of all our patients.
Mm.
And, you know, having this stress foisted upon us, it has been very difficult for many members who've been affected.
And that visibility, as you've noted, Dermot, was because of lockdown a vulnerability. I note that your survey shows that of the pharmacies who experienced crime, 8% experienced the theft of prescription medicines, 15% had controlled drugs stolen. That has to be of concern both to individual pharmacists but to the community as a whole.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, as you know, medicines need to be taken appropriately. Obviously, if medicines get into the illicit market or stolen or available for resale, then that can have consequences. And obviously, controlled drugs, they're controlled for a particular reason, that it's for issues of safety as well. So obviously, you know, we don't want those getting into the wrong hands, and they can have consequences, obviously, for members of the public as well. It can be quite dangerous for them.
So what lessons or learnings, Dermot, should be taken from this survey of your members in terms of both their experience and their attitude to those experiences with regard to crime over the last 12 months?
Yeah, thanks, Ciara. I suppose a few things. I think nationally crime reduced over the last 12 months, but there were still significant numbers of crimes against pharmacies and pharmacists. And I suppose that's probably due to the visibility and the fact that we were open when, unfortunately, many businesses weren't. I suppose the big thing for us really is that, you know, the Gardaí have been very helpful in individual cases, and we welcome that. But it's really important that, you know, that the Gardaí have a visible presence on the streets and also in their communities, so that you know, they can be a deterrent and also available to pharmacies, and, you know, just to show that that communities are being protected. So a kind of a visibility scenario is very important to us, where Gardaí have a high level of visibility.
Now, on a slightly different but related matter, I know your IPU colleague Cathy Marr was being interviewed about this yesterday, and I suppose it was the Irish experience in the context of the fact that contraceptive pills are now available to buy over-the-counter in pharmacies. I think only in England. I'm not sure if it's across the entirety of the UK. But Dermot, what's your view of that? Should that be a system mirrored in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, look, I suppose it's a very welcome development. We've always said as an organisation that it's important that contraception is available, that it's accessible to people, and also that barrier to like cost isn't a barrier to people getting it. So I suppose there's two things at play here. One is its availability without prescription, which improves accessibility. And the second thing, which we've been highlighting to the Minister for Health here for a number of years, is the availability without cost or free of charge. And that would hopefully help to reduce unwanted pregnancies. Pharmacies, you know, we've been involved for a number of years with providing emergency hormonal contraception in a very successful way, both to private and also medical card patients. And we would see this as a natural extension of the service. Obviously, there would be guidelines and procedures to be followed, but we think it's a welcome development to allow the accessibility and also to free up doctor surgeries.
And in your talks with the department, Dermot, did you get any sense of an inclination towards such a move?
Yeah, I think, now as I say, I wasn't involved myself at the time, but certainly some previous ministers for health were very pro this idea. And unfortunately, as you know, Ciara, I suppose COVID has
overtaken so many things. Yeah.
But at the same time, it shouldn't stop progress being made in areas where there are benefits to be made. And, you know, I suppose we'd be looking to call on the department to re-engage in this, and I think there's going to be a high-level task force looking at it more closely. But certainly it seems to be progressive, it seems to be the way forward. It's about accessibility and affordability and making it available to people, and you know, we're certainly very pro it. Our members, as I said, have been involved in dispensing emergency hormonal contraception for a number of years now, and that has worked very well, both for the medical card and for private patients.
Well, Dermot Toomey, President of the Irish Pharmacy Union, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, as you will have heard on our news bulletins today, a new proposal to increase the number of homes on the rental market and make nursing homes more accessible for families is being proposed by the Housing Minister. Residents of nursing homes could be able to rent out their family home and be exempt from the state's Fair Deal scheme. At present, 80% of the rental income earned by any person who is renting out their family home whilst a resident of the nursing home is taken by government to pay for their care. However, we understand that families under this new proposal would be able to retain 100% of the rental income. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Sarah Lennon, Executive Director of Sage Advocacy. Sarah, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to do so. What's your initial reaction to Dara O'Brien's proposal?
I think our initial reaction in Sage Advocacy would be that this is very much an initiative being driven by the Housing Minister in response to what is clearly a housing need. And I know from reports that Mary Butler herself, the Minister for Older People, has had concerns over this proposal. And in Sage Advocacy, we'll share a lot of those concerns. I think there's definitely potential upside for people, for older people and their families to this, but we will be concerned that some of the proposals might lead to some safeguarding or risk of abuse issues.
And how could they arise, those particular issues?
Well, at present, I suppose if an older person is in a nursing home, as you mentioned at the top, 80% of the income you can go towards the contribution. And I suppose one of the concerns we would have in Sage is that if 100% of the income from a rental property is now to be available to the family, that might incentivise people to move their mother, father or grandparents to a nursing home earlier than they might have chosen to, or maybe they wouldn't have chosen to at all. So I think there needs to be some assurances, I think, as part of this scheme, that the person who owns the home, the resident, the person who's living at home, that they actually have a choice in relation to moving to the nursing home. And they actually also will receive the money themselves in terms of making sure that it goes towards their quality of life.
Also, I'm wondering how government is going to square this circle, Sarah, and I'm speaking somewhat speculatively. If at present 80% of the rental income earned from renting out the home of a person who is normally now resident in a nursing home is used to pay for that care, how is the care going to be paid for then in that context of Fair Deal if 100% then goes to the householder?
The suggestion is that people are deliberately leaving the houses vacant, or perhaps they're not vacant, but it's not being declared in some way. I think there was some speculation, and again, it was just in newspaper reports, that there might have been about 25,000 properties. When you bear in mind there's about 30,000 to 32,000 nursing home residents, that's not a million miles apart in terms of figures. So there's definitely a suggestion that in some way this money isn't making its way into the nursing homes, actually, even at present. But it's certainly not making its way a lot of the time into the pockets of the nursing home residents.
And I would imagine, like, there's going to be exceptions to every group of people, but it would seem that the assumption is, or what we understand the assumption to be, that there might be 25,000 homes of people who are now living in nursing homes that are vacant for one reason or another. They may have actively and consciously elected that. But there are only between 30 and 32,000. That seems a very, very high estimate. Would that ring true with your experience, Sarah?
I think in our experience, people maybe in nursing homes, or maybe people who are in acute hospitals, and we know that those vacant homes might not all be nursing home residents, and you have to say that. In some cases, they may be temporarily vacant, and people fully intend to return. Unfortunately, as part of Sage's work, you know, it's not an everyday occurrence, but we have had experiences of people going into hospital, older people going into hospital for a short stay, and a family member occupying the house and changing the locks. So, I think it's, you know, once an older person has vacated their home, there is a risk there that they may not be able to return to it, or if it's used in some other way that they won't enjoy the benefit of it. I mean, we should say the vast majority of families obviously support and cherish their older members within their family, but unfortunately there are a number of unscrupulous people out there.
Well, is there a set of measures that you would have preferred in Sage Advocacy to see other than what the Housing Minister is proposing today?
I suppose, look, we do welcome, and as I said, there is a benefit here if the money comes in and the resident can use it. At present, an awful lot of nursing home residents and their families have to put their hands into their pocket for things like social activities or physiotherapies, those types of measures. So if the money can be used by the resident to improve their quality of life, all to the good. But I think what we need here is instead of maybe tinkering with aspects of the Fair Deal scheme, what we were promised in the programme for government is a commission on care which would look at the Fair Deal and home care and say, well, why is long-term care deliberately biased towards nursing home care? Can we do more to keep people in their own homes longer, living in their own communities with the supports they need? So we're really calling on the government to, while these measures are important for many reasons, to actually grasp the nettle and put in place that commission on care that will look at the whole issue of long-term care.
It does seem that it is a bit reluctant to do that grasping, because I know you in Sage Advocacy and other advocacy groups and campaign groups and indeed commercial groups in this space have long been calling for a reform of the Fair Deal scheme and that emphasis on in-home care, because that is what most people want given the choice. And yet, here we are.
It's definitely what most people want, or they tell us anyway that they would want given the choice, but unfortunately their choice is often made in the absence of the support they need to stay at home, and the nursing home appears like the only option. I think there's a real danger that if we don't start to plan now, we know that the age demographic in Ireland, we're getting older, and the demand for long-term care is only going to get more intense as all of us age, and if we don't have an honest conversation now about what we want as a vision for our long-term care, and importantly, Ciara, how we're going to pay for this, then we really are, we're sitting on a ticking time bomb, and it's not going to go away even if we don't address it.
Sarah Lennon, Executive Director at Sage Advocacy, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, Down Syndrome Ireland is celebrating its 50th birthday, and to mark that, it has conducted a very significant new survey called Upside. And to discuss this and the unveiling today, a very special mural in Dublin City Centre, I'm joined on the line by Chief Executive of Down Syndrome Ireland, Barry Sheridan. Barry, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so, and happy birthday to everybody in Down Syndrome Ireland. Upside has shown, really in a nutshell, very significant gaps in inclusion for people with Down Syndrome, virtually in all walks of life.
Absolutely. I suppose, first of all, you know, 50th anniversary, and we're kicking the campaign for 50th anniversary off with the Upside. And really what it shows the gaps between what the public attitudes and societal aspirations towards inclusion are, and really the harsh realities of people with Down syndrome and their families throughout the country. So part of what we want to show is the real positive progression we've made over the last 50 years, but also to highlight we've got so much more to go and so much more to do to be truly inclusive.
One of the things that really struck me as a result of the study was that 60% of second-level students with Down syndrome want to go on to further education, but less than half that number either do or have the facility to do so.
Absolutely, and even of that 29% that are taking part in further education, a lot of them would be doing that within their day services, so it's not within your college or further education setting that a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. So there's a huge gap there in terms of what people with Down syndrome want and what the reality is on the ground. And I think, you know, we've made great strides over the last number of years in developing further education programs for people who are with Down syndrome. But we're a charity. We shouldn't be providing that. That should be provided by the state. And we think more could be done to address that gap and make it more inclusive for everyone.
And I imagine that educational experience has a knock-on effect to the employment experience. I note that of members of the public, they believe a fifth of people with Down syndrome are in paid employment. The reality is 6%. That is extraordinarily low.
It is extraordinarily low. And I think an important point is that was pre-pandemic figures.
Yeah.
So the last 18 months has brought a whole new load of challenges to people seeking employment, people in employment, and really, you know, I think, you know, what we have seen is that the experience for employers, the experience for employees, the experience for people with Down syndrome to get the opportunity for meaningful employment, and that means paid employment, is so significant, and it's such a knock-on and positive contribution that they can make that we really need to be doing more. And that's across the board, that's government, that's employers, that's employees, and trying to build on the success and the evidence that we have that shows that it can be hugely beneficial to have members of your workforce with Down syndrome, that they can contribute wholly to the success of any company.
I know that the survey also looked at perceptions of health experience. The vast majority of members of the public, some 80%, believe waiting times should be no longer than 6 months for someone with Down syndrome to receive their health assessments, tests and begin whatever therapies are relevant to them. But pre-pandemic, the average number of therapy sessions for a person with Down syndrome was 5 a year. I would imagine that that situation has only worsened, Barry.
Absolutely. You know, we have people and members around the country who are waiting and haven't had any access to any therapies at all in the last couple of years. And really, in this day and age, that is really not acceptable. You know, what we can say for definite is that we know for a fact that access for intervention, and that should be continuous, it should be frequent, can have a knock-on effect then for education, which has a knock-on effect then for further education, which has a knock-on effect then for seeking employment.
Mm.
So it's the whole lot, and that needs to start with early intervention and access to proper early intervention that can really provide people with Down syndrome with the proper potential and opportunities and access to opportunities that will help them develop to their full potential.
Now, Down Syndrome Ireland has been making these statements, making these recommendations, making these calls, I would imagine, for every single one of the 50 years of its existence. What, Barry, do you think has changed now that somebody might act on them?
Well, what's really interesting is that we're using the data from the public's perceptions and what the public expect to see. And the public, 90% of the public, are saying that they want the state to fully support and to provide the level of services that are required for people with Down syndrome to live a full and active part in their community. And I think 50 years ago, in 1971, we were in a very different space. People with Down syndrome, the life expectancy is much higher now than what it would have been 50 years ago. But who's to say that we've come far enough? We really haven't. We have members, volunteers, parents all over the country that day in, day out have to battle for basic services that really should be provided and that they should have access to. And really what we hope that this report does, the Upside Life with Down Syndrome will do, is draw attention to it, build public awareness, and get people actually to have the conversation and go, it's just not good enough. We need to do a little bit more here. And not just a little bit more, we need to do a lot more, because the people of this country, we all want to live and expect to live in an inclusive society, and we've made great strides over the last couple of decades in doing that as a country. But what we're trying to highlight is, for people with Down syndrome in this country, there's still a way to go.
And part of living that full and active life that you mentioned, Barry, that most respondents to the survey felt was owed to people with Down syndrome is visibility. And to that end, there's a really, really joyful mural that has been unveiled of 21-year-old Amanda Butler from Mullingar, created by artist Joe Caslin. Tell us about it.
It's such a wonderful, positive piece, and, you know, very much what we want to celebrate as part of our 50 years are our members. And we want them to have their voice, we want them to be visible, and we want people to see them, not see a disability. And what the mural does, and Joe Caslin, he's a, you know, phenomenal artist who worked really closely with Amanda and developed this piece, which is so positive. I think the vibrancy and the energy that she brings to the picture and to life in itself is something that should be noticed and should be talked about. And that, because what that shows is the potential, and that shows where we need to get to. You know, Amanda needs the opportunity to fulfill all her aspirations and all her dreams as she grows up. And I think what Joe has really done is a beautiful mural in Dublin City Centre, where people should and expect and have already stopped and take notice and go, that's just fantastic, and how can I get involved and how can I help you?
Well, Barry Sheridan, Chief Executive of Down Syndrome Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. And if you want to see that mural, you can find it on kfmradio.com, and all, including links to that keynote study conducted by Down Syndrome Ireland, the Upside Life with Down Syndrome report.